From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson and for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Golden Globe, Emmy, Tony Award-winning actress Mary Louise Parker is known for owning the stage in Weeds, The West Wing, Angels in America, the Broadway play Proof, and the film Fried Green Tomatoes. Now she's taking on the literary world with her first book. It's a series of letters to the men in her life who she says shaped who she is. This hour on Point, actress Mary Louise Parker on her literary debut, Dear Mr. You. Joining me from New York City, Mary Louise Parker. The new book is called Dear Mr. You. So great to have you with us.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So critics are calling this book dazzling. They say your, quote, poet's prose is lyrical, funny, sad, strange, and very often beautiful, end quote. The letters are little character sketches, aren't they? Is that how you describe them?
I think of the book, really, it isn't my story, this book. It's really a bunch of thank you notes is how I look on it. And it's just little snapshots, little illustrations of moments that affected me specifically through my experiences with men. And it's just a little meditation, a little celebration of the male gender. And it's a positive book, and it's meant to be full of gratitude, and it's just a celebration of men that I've found heroic and compelling, and or who held a mirror up to me.
We know you from, of course, The West Wing, Angels in America, Fried Green Tomatoes, Weeds. Your acting has so often been praised as intense and raw and vulnerable, and I think the same can be said about your writing here. What gave you the idea to structure this book as a series of letters to men who've shaped your life?
Well, it was really just sort of happened organically. I don't necessarily think of these men as having shaped my life. I think of them having more as informed the way I see life and see myself and see men in general, which is, again, this is all about the positive. And it happened. I was writing for Esquire. I wrote for Esquire for a number of years and still do from time to time. And I was lucky enough to get to do that. And they asked me to write something about men. And I said, I think that's a little bit general, isn't it? And I didn't know how I was going to do it. And I hung up the phone and I didn't even move from where I was sitting. And it just kind of flew out of me in letter form. I don't know why, but I really loved writing with that direct address and just sort of throwing everything in there. It just felt like a litany, and it felt like I was allowed to be as poetic as I wanted with it. And I just felt like I could have kept writing it forever. And when I was writing other things, you know, touching on short stories and things like that, and I kept going back to that. I just liked speaking to people directly, men in general. I just, there was something about it I found really freeing, and I felt like I could just kind of, they could take whatever shape they wanted.
Did you ever send any of the letters in your book?
I did. The ones that are official. Well, some of them I can't really send the one to NASA.
Right.
But my best friend her baby is Dear Little Owl. She has her letter, and her husband is also really at the core of that letter as well. And, you know, people have read them, and I wanted them to. I wanted it to be, I love letters, you know, and I love getting them. And it's people are so happy when you really take the time to consider them and sort of wrestle your thoughts of them onto paper. People really love it.
You mentioned Dear Little Owl, one of the letters from your book. Part of that. This is, you were in the delivery room witnessing the birth of one of your friend's children, and you write a letter to that child.
Yeah, it was an incredible gift getting to be there that day. Okay. Dear Little Owl, you are nothing yet in the absolute best way, and I am your eyes since yours haven't opened. You've not even met air. Or purple, or snow, or your mother, who is my friend. She is lying here so ready to hatch you. Embarrassment is years away. Ditto candy and kissing. Falcons, punchlines, and regret are even further down the road, with certain agonies that I hope never appear. I tell you this now before you can speak. Strength is a myth. It's not what it is when it looks like what it is. It's usually what it is when it looks like something else. It takes bravery to admit that you're petrified and keep soldiering on despite it. Oh, and easy? Also a hoax. If it existed, it could be sold for the same as what you got it for. Nothing. Ha! Gather perseverance, perspicacity, and pez. Be wary of guilty pleasures. Best to open the floodgates and let pleasure wash over you until you're floating in its yummy, with not a wink to guilt. Try saving guilt for having gossiped or disappointed your children. Be sheepish about not reading Proust or neglecting to offer your car at the right moment or your kidney. Don't tell lies. Lying will slowly set your soul on decay, unless you really and truly must lie, in which case lie your eyeballs off. Lie until your nose grows so long it touches the floor when you drop your head in shame, but then go seek forgiveness. It's terrifically useful to recognize where you are lacking in relation to others, accept and even celebrate it, because envy will poison. It will give you acid reflux and strange, pervasive malodors. I believe you will know when the time comes about Colorado, the Beatles, and the high road, about keeping secret your good deeds and giving when you don't have enough set aside for yourself. I know that you'll find and be found.
It's beautiful. You're a Golden Globe, Emmy-winning, Tony Award-winning actress. Most of us know you as an actor. Does writing exercise a different creative muscle for you?
Well, it's funny because I've written longer than I've been acting. I've written my whole life, and I save. I save everything I've ever written, pretty much. And I have little books that I made when I was 8 or 9 years old. I have one that's I found the other day, actually. It was called How I Finally Got a Horse, which I never finished because I never got a horse. But it was a little paper book thing that I tried to cut into the shape of a book. And I've always written, so it's always – it didn't feel like something that I was taking on or trying on. But it just – I was so – I was so thrilled to get the opportunity to do it and to have people believe in me enough to give me this chance to write an actual book. So it just felt like something that's always been in me.
The book begins with a very powerful letter to your father titled Dear Daddy. How did he shape this book?
Well, he really is so, I mean, he's the single greatest influence of my life. He and my mother as well. My father really, I imprinted so much from my father, and so much of me is what I saw in him and my keeping watch over him and worrying for him and being championed by him. I share so many of his qualities and his love of books, his love of words and poems and stories and mystery. He was really a phenomenal man, and I don't think I quite realized. I always knew how much he supported me and championed me and how I felt like that was the one opinion that I cared about. And then once he was gone, it was as though I felt like I was standing on a stage and the entire audience just got up and left. It was I felt like, well, should I continue? Should I ever even attempt anything special again? Because he won't be able to see it. It was a great loss for me losing him.
I love this part of that letter. You're a single mom. You've got two children. You say, "And dear Daddy, this is your family I'm running here. I can't take credit for more than remembering to point up to you when I do something right and continue to put one foot in front of the other when I lose heart." This is not a memoir, Mary Louise Parker, but a lot of memoirs, especially celebrity memoirs, are quite popular these days. Why didn't you go that direction?
That's not really what I would like to put out into the world. I'm not, I don't want to have anything that's an expose or some sort of indictment or a bunch of salacious stories with my name on it, you know. books and are too important to me to ever engage in something like that. I know that that's a kind of book that, that sells well, but that was not the priority for me. And I can go to sleep at night really thinking I tried to write something about gratitude and a Valentine to men and about my love of men. I have a son. I don't know why I would want to put anything out into the world that was anything less than positive or a rumination on what I find heroic about men.
Did you write any letters that were not for publication?
There were some I really wanted to write, and they just didn't happen. And then there were a bunch that I wrote that it felt like, oh, that note has already kind of been covered over here, or some of them began to feel recursive in a way, and it just seemed like these were the ones that fit together. There was one that I really loved, Dear Painter, about this painter that I knew, Jules Olitski. He's one of my favorite artists. And in the end, it just didn't feel like it belonged in this book stylistically. And I felt it was hard because I felt, how can I have a book about men without Jules in it?
Well, we'll hear more of your letters after the break. We're talking with Mary Louise Parker, author of the new book, Dear Mr. You. And you can link to an excerpt on our website, onpointradio.org. Listeners, you can join the conversation, What Do You Hear?, in Mary Louise Parker's letters. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. Much more after this break. We'll be right back. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with Mary Louise Parker this hour. She of the Showtime series Weeds, of Broadway, of the films Red and Fried Green Tomatoes. She's out with a new book, Dear Mr. You, to rave reviews. You can read an excerpt on our website, onpointradio.org, and you can join the conversation here. Are you a fan of Mary Louise Parker? Does the famous emotion that she exhibits on stage translate to her work in this book? In season 6 of Weeds, Nancy Botwin has to flee from her drug lord husband after one of her sons killed an associate of the drug lord who threatened him. As they pack the car to flee in the middle of the night, Nancy apologizes to older son Silas for being a bad mother, while chastising her younger son Shane for being a killer.
So sorry. But now you have the handbook for what not to do. And as we drive far away from here, we can talk about the many ways in which I failed you, or we can play license plate bingo. I'll let you decide.
I'm not sitting on the hump. Move over.
I'm already buckled.
Well, unbuckle and move to the middle.
You really don't want to mess with me, you know.
Move over now!
Ow! What is it with you and the violence?
Don't play the whole I'm a killer now card. That is unacceptable.
There is Mary Louise Parker in Weeds, season 6. Mary Louise, I think one of the funnier letters in your book, Dear Mr. You, is, and one of my favorites, is the letter you wrote, Dear Future Man Who Loves My Daughter. Mm. Tell us about that one.
That one came out, it sort of wrote itself. I wasn't planning on writing it, and it just sort of rushed out of me, and I didn't tinker with it very much at all after the first writing of it, and it just felt very easy, and it was kind of delightful to write in a way, and imagining my daughter later and me coming back from the grave if should anyone slight her, you know, to sort of haunt them forever.
Read some of it. Here's a Dear Future Man Who Loves My Daughter, Mary Louise Parker.
Dear Future Man Who Loves My Daughter, first of all, show up a bit late. It may be better if she's seen a little of the opposite of you and relaxes in your arms only once she realizes you don't have a gruesome face hiding under the one you first showed her. Do not have another face hiding? Yeah, I really would not. Swoop in late, but not so late that she doesn't trust it when you say you want to make her drunk on happiness. Make her drunk on happy. Make her unhappy. Put yourself first. Do that a while. Do it long enough so that she suffers. When she is done with that suffering, which will only make her more compassionate, watch as she rises up like the sea's last wave and crushes you with her silence. Notice how that silence moves in on you as she speaks, telling you that she's had enough and you have to change. You will see her mouth moving and recognize the words falling out and forming sentences that mean, quit this moment or I will quit you. But the quiet that continues to threaten with staying forever if you don't comply, that is so much louder than her words. She will not be crying or begging. She will realize she is powerful and perfect alone and that she doesn't need you. Her commitment to those words will terrify you. You will change for her because you realize no one is more worthy of changing for. Remind her that she is beautiful in every new language you can invent. Careful with metaphor, as by then her mother's overuse of it may have exhausted her and made her immune to poetry. Remind her about poetry. If she has given you children, remind yourself every day of the second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth words in this sentence. If you hurt her in ways that are irreparable, I will send out people to hurt you back. Sorry, but it has to be that way. Yes, you may have had a difficult childhood, but please allow me to introduce myself. Hello, I am the woman who doesn't give a shit. Make her something warm to drink in the mornings and give her time to begin speaking. Only rush at her with an embrace or a gemstone, wildflowers, a love note, Yeats. Do not fight with her in public. This almost includes the dog. She has an elegance that should not be polluted by compromising her privacy. This has something to do with loyalty. I am not sure how, but it does. Speak glowingly of her to everyone, even on the days she has infuriated you. Inflate. You have landed the loveliest girl walking the earth. Let too many people know how proud you are so that it gets back to her and she feels proud to be herself.
So this is not a tell-all book, but you do open up about heartbreak and relationships. In a couple of letters, it seems like you're making peace with several men who have mistreated you. Was that intended?
No, I don't really look at it like that. I mean, I think that they were just moments that still resonate with me that moments that I'm grateful for, that I learned something, that either by the culmination of that moment compounded by another one like it, or the collision of a bunch of similar moments, or someone being generous to me in the face of my, you know, being blinded by my own, you know, preoccupation with something else. Any sort of allusions to anything tabloid or expose or something like that all really puts ice in my veins. And I think you can tell from the first three lines of the book that I wasn't interested in writing anything like that. And it's just, you know, relationships that are painful, they become a conversation you have with yourself over time. And those are conversations that I'm still having. It's not as though I've figured anything out. I feel like, you know, there are ways to learn, and there are ways to learn to be more compassionate to others, either by the way we've mistreated others or we've been mistreated ourselves. And there's a reason why in Cerberus I present myself as almost the perfect little hero who's like above reproach, and then there's this demon on the other side. I turned it into more of a cartoon, you know, so that I thought it would bring levity to it, and it wouldn't read like something where I was trying to elicit sympathy. You know, it's because, as I say, it's like I could be the evil person in someone else's story. It's just, this is my story, and I wanted to tell it in a way that was funny and also like fair.
You mentioned Dear Cerberus in a wonderful review yesterday. The New York Times says that one of the letters sure to get the most attention is that letter, Dear Cerberus, in which three bad boyfriends take the form of a three-headed dog. You know, you obscure identifying details of the men in that letter, though many remember the tabloid storm you endured when your longtime partner, Billy Crudup, left you for the young actress Claire Danes. You were 7 months pregnant, I think. That was such a public humiliation most people can't imagine enduring. How did you get through that?
Well, that part of my life is nothing I'm ever going to be interested in talking about for a number of reasons. But first of all, just that it's personal. But when you have a story that's written about a three-headed dog, I think you have to kind of assume that the writer has taken a certain kind of license, you know, a certain kind of freedom. And it may, in fact, be four men. It may be one man. It may be two. And, you know, it was my creatively trying to, as I said, like, show the polar sides of how we remember things and how when we arrive at a place where we think we've finally figured something out, things tend to keep popping up. They keep, that same dog head keeps growing, you know, keeps growing in front of us, and we think we've learned something, but maybe we have to learn it again. And it wasn't, it's not also a story about being mistreated. It's a story about my not getting things and my being complicit in things and my conjuring and provoking things myself and not even understanding it yet. I'm sure if I looked at those relationships in 10 years and wanted to write about, you know, them, it would be an entirely different story. I just thought it was fun to write it like a fairy tale and be able to change the font. But but in terms of my private life, I'll just never be anyone who's willing to sort of expunge like details in a way that I feel like, you know, like we don't need any more witch hunts, really.
A lot of listeners want to get in here. Let's get Adelaide in from Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, Adelaide. Welcome to On Hi. Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I have a question for Ms. Parker. I'm also an actor and a director for the stage, and I was wondering, as a writer, how she's found the works of the various playwrights that she has performed and engaged with have influenced her writing.
Thank you.
That's a really, really good question. Thank you. They've affected me massively, massively. And starting with Craig Lucas and seeing how he could just take economy to an entirely different level and rhythm. I learned so much from doing his plays. Paula Vogel and Tony Kushner. And then recently I worked with Simon Stevens, who just completely blew my mind on a whole other level. Also with just the way he was in the room as a playwright, he was so generous and so fair and beyond respectful of the actors and the director, and just his use of language was so different from any other writer I've ever worked with, and he has such a fresh voice. It was just, and getting to say his words every night was a massive gift. Massive.
Several of the letters in this book are addressed to people you don't know, Mary Louise Parker, and there's a sense that you think a lot about whether someone can really know another person. Does that question drive you as an actor as well?
When I first did Craig Lucas's play, Prelude to a Kiss, he really, that was sort of the central focus of that play. And it did spark something in me. And I do think it's something that everyone thinks about. People are constantly surprising you. And I don't know that it's necessarily, can you know someone comprehensively? It's, you can't necessarily predict who you will be knowing in 5 minutes or 5 years, because people are constantly evolving or devolving, depending on how you want to look at it. So that it is a question that does fascinate me. But it certainly doesn't disturb me or haunt me. It's not something that bothers me. I do think it's interesting, though.
Let's go to Sophia in Miami, Florida. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Hello, Ms. Parker. So I was listening, and I was really struck by how much appreciation that's really directed at men, and how I just wanted to say that a lot of times it feels as if I'm a woman, and I often don't thank the men in my life for their impact on my life, either good or bad. And just really listening to the show, it just showed me that I really need to start doing that a lot more, because they play such a big role in my life, and that I really need to start looking at them and saying thank you. And I feel like they don't hear that as much as well. And I wanted to hear your point of view on that.
That is absolutely the best thing you could have possibly said to me this morning, and I am so grateful to you. I think sometimes we spend so much of our lives feeling underappreciated, you know, or misunderstood or not seen. And sometimes, you know, I have a friend who always says to me, you know, I always think, what can I do? What can I do? And I think reaching out is to show your gratitude to other people is massively healing, and it grows you in a sense. And it's almost like a tiny version of what I tell my kids sometimes when they're nervous, you know. I get often nervous in crowds or at parties or things like that, and I tell them, you know, ask someone about themselves and see if you can really, really be truly interested in them. And sometimes that will sort of quell your own fears or anxiety, because so much of it is, and this is maybe just for me, it's why am I thinking about myself at the party? Why am I so focused on what people think of me? Other people are thinking that too. And I think that's a tiny version of a, you know, that's sort of the macro version of that is just trying to come from a place of gratitude, which is enormously challenging at times, right? But as you said, it's like there's generally someone in front of you who could be thanked for something. And writing these letters, I discovered so much in myself that was lacking, or stories that I didn't really understand, where I'd made myself the hero and I wasn't. And people so appreciated being thanked, and people so appreciated being remembered. And my neighbor said to me, I can't believe you remembered all that, or I can't believe you were actually listening when I said all that. And it just meant a lot to him. So I do think it's a powerful thing.
I must say, some of the passages feel as though they could have been mined from old journals. There's such detail in these letters. Maybe you just have a really good memory.
I do have a very good memory, except for things like, where did I put the mail? Until somebody says it's in the refrigerator. So I have a very distracted, absent-minded person, but I have an insane memory for, you know, expressions that I saw wash across someone's face or something like that. And I do keep not only journals, but I save pieces of paper or envelopes that I've written down, verses or things that seemed important at the time, or little conversations that I wanted to remember. I have bits of paper and journals saved from many, many years.
Let's get Nicole in here in Bolton, Vermont. Hi, Nicole. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Ms. Parker. I guess I have two questions, and one you've, Ms. Parker, you've spoken to already, a little bit about your literary influences. I'm more interested in short story fiction, and I was curious about what influenced you in that genre. But if that's a little bit redundant,
I love that question. Specifically cool. Short stories. I love short stories. I love Edna O'Brien, and I just got the Love Object, her collection of short stories, which is beautiful. I love Debbie Eisenberg. I think she's a genius. I love Laurie Moore. I love Prima Levi's stories. I do read an awful lot of poetry, but I read fiction as well, and this year there were so many great books to read. Miranda July's book and Mary Carr's book, The Art of the Memoir, and The Empathy Exams, I thought was an incredible book. And I loved Kevin Young has a book of poetry that is beautiful as well.
Thanks so much for the call, Nicole. We're here with Mary Louise Parker. You can join us in this conversation. What's your question for this award-winning actress? What's your question about motherhood, about men? I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour with actress Mary Louise Parker. Her new book is Dear Mr. You, and you can join the conversation. Does the real Mary Louise Parker surprise you, inspire you? Here is some sound of Mary Louise Parker in action. This is from the third season of West Wing in 2002. at a birthday party for the First Lady, Amy Gardner, played by Mary Louise Parker, trying to convince her boyfriend, Josh Lyman, who is the deputy chief of staff, thinking about the presidential election campaign and asking to hire more women for campaign jobs.
You're not hiring enough women in senior positions for the campaign.
How do you know?
Because it's my job to know.
We're in a dangerous area right now.
Women were the only voters. Democrats would win in a landslide every time. If men were the only voters, the GOP would be the left-wing party. Women are going to be 60% of your vote. Don't you think they should make up, I don't know, 40% of the campaign staff?
Mary Louise Parker, you know, back to the book for a moment. One of the most powerful of all the letters in the book, to my mind, is called Dear Oyster Picker. The New York Times says, quote, "It's a good and true enough story to draw tears." And indeed it did, I must say. The idea of an oyster picker is a sort of roundabout way of describing your dad, your dad's last meal, his death. Can you tell us about that story and what that meant to you?
Well, my editor, Colin Harrison, I felt like I had this letter, Dear Daddy, and I wanted to continue the thread of my father throughout the book because it was really so much inspired by him. And when I think hero, that's what I think of first. And he said, oh, no, you haven't begun to write about your father. And just that phrase was really massively freeing for me, and it gave me permission to write that last story, which came to me. I don't even know how it came. I just started, you know, I have saved those oysters and they are in my home. And it just came out of the oysters. I don't know how. And it came out in long stretches of writing to the point where I could barely stand up. I'd been sitting writing for 4 or 5 hours and it just felt so good. And it felt like I brought him back for that little bit of time when I was writing it. I felt like I got to have my dad back just for a moment.
Let's go to Owen in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hi, Owen. Welcome to the program with Mary Louise Parker.
Hi, Jane. I just wanted to call because I was like very like profoundly touched by what Ms. Parker said in regards to her dad and how when he passed, she felt like he was no longer in his audience, because I can really identify with that after ending like a very serious relationship. And I was wondering why I was getting these feelings. And I think a big part of it is I miss being in his audience and I miss him being in mine. And just like that, like collaboration with somebody who's like profoundly impactful in your life, was just something that I really miss. And I was wondering if Ms. Parker could talk more about like that process and like, I don't know, about a reformation of the audience or like a rebirth or something.
Right.
It is so
very hard, isn't it? And it's funny because there was a priest there when my father died, and I said to her, you know, it hadn't even been an hour after he passed, and I said, I feel like I don't care if I ever do anything special again. And she said, what do you think your dad would say to that? And I knew exactly what he would say. I could see the set of his face. I could see, you know, the pitch of his body in the chair. I just knew all of it. And it really helped me. So I think imagining that conversation sometimes really helps to move you forward. And I think, well, this book wouldn't exist if he were here, even though I would give anything on earth to be able to hand it to him. It almost feels like they say, you know, this is a part of the relationship too. When the person is gone, it's not the most fun part, and I really, really have to believe in my soul that it isn't the last part. And I'm going to be so angry if it is. But this is another part of the relationship when they're gone, and it's the part where you're having to. It may feel as though you're speaking into a vacuum, but I don't think that you are. I think that there is something that remains, and I don't mean that in the metaphysical sense, and I don't even mean it in a religious sense. I mean it in a just the way that it's just ineffable. It's something that can't be described, and it's what makes me believe that maybe there will be another another part of it, another stage, another time, and something that, that we don't understand yet. That's just me hoping, but then I'm just a poor human, and I don't, you know, I don't have any of the answers, but it, it's something that I have to cling to because it's just, it, it's too great a loss for me to fathom it ending right here.
Owen, thank you so much for the call. Ray is in North Kingstown, Rhode Island. Ray, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hi. Jane, and hello, Mary Louise.
Hi.
Hello?
Yes, go
Hi.
Ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I have two questions. The first one is, in that first passage you read regarding your experience in the birthing room from that letter, you mentioned a falcon. Was there any significance to that?
Oh, I love that you remembered that. I don't know where that falcon came from. And I think when I was in my early 20s, I listened to Ricky Lee Jones a lot, and I was writing a lot of poems. And I always loved the way things would just sort of land on the paper and you didn't know where they came from. And I heard her once say, she was talking about a song she wrote, and in the middle of the song, she sings this line, "You break my heart, Carol." And I remember hearing her talk about, she would say, "Who is Carol? Why is Carol suddenly in my song?" And then she learned not to question it. And just to take it. And I don't know what that song would be without that line. And I think you just have to, sometimes I love when those little things come out of nowhere. I don't know where that came from, the falcons. I really don't, but I accepted it. And I feel like maybe it'll mean something one day to him, to that little boy who was born on that day. I don't know.
Ray, thanks so much for the call. Mary Louise, you talk a lot in the book about your role as a parent and about parenting, especially parenting alone. You have two children, as I mentioned. Talk about that a little bit. You wonder who your children will become, what kind of parent you want to be. I'm curious, how did becoming a parent change who you are and change your relationship with the men in your life?
Well, there's nothing more humbling than being a parent, I don't think. You're constantly reminded of how, you know, you'll never do things quite as well as you'd like to. And it's also incredibly fortifying because when you do feel like you've done something well or your child is doing well or they're happy or thriving, there's no greater feeling. It's a bit of a race that I feel like you'll only ever hope to come in second. And I do get the sense sometimes I feel like I'm constantly running and I have to slow down and say, okay, I have to let those six things go and just kind of be here with my kids. And I have the luxury of doing that because I have stretches of time off and I've spent a lot of time with them and time reading to them and cooking with them and making games and traveling and putting on shows and things like that. And I'm just really lucky in that way. But you never know what's going to happen with your kid in the next moment. And it's this constant sense of like trying to stay on top of it and them and somewhere between anticipating and letting things be can be fairly exhausting.
Here's Michael in Parsons, Kansas. Michael, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Mary Louise, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
First saw you in Fried Green Tomatoes, of which my wife actually drugged me to. And I was so pleasantly surprised with your performance. You just completely overwhelmed me. You remind
Thank
me
you.
So much of my two daughters, and I'm so pleased that you talk about your father the way you do. My daughters talk about me in kind of funny ways, the funny things that I do, but I really respect the things that they love about me. And just hearing you speak about your father gives me hope for the future. And I just want to tell you that I think you're probably my favorite actress.
Oh, nice. God, thank you so much. That means a lot to me. Thank you. And it's funny the way that we talk about our parents. It just evolves over time and gets to the point where those little anecdotes become myths, that become stories, that become part of who we are. And then suddenly, like, there's your hero, you know?
Michael, thank you so much for the call. Here's John in Boston. John, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Hi, Mary Louise.
Hi.
I just would love to thank you for your exquisite prose and your It just is wonderful to hear somebody and your exquisite taste in keeping your private life private, which I think is absolutely wonderful. And the other thing I would like to thank you for is I just had the pleasure of, on a flight back from Orlando last weekend, of seeing you in red. And it was the most wonderful 2 hours watching that in the plane. Watching your work was just absolutely phenomenal.
John,
thank you so much. My gosh.
A lot of fans calling
you
today, Mary Louise Parker.
Kind, and thank you for validating my wish to keep some things to myself. I appreciate hearing that more than you can possibly know.
Would you rather be on stage or screen? Theater, television, or film,
stage.
Mary Louise Parker? Yeah?
Stage.
I thought you would say that, but I still had to ask.
Well, I started off, you know, in drama school, and I really had aspirations of being a regional theater actress. And I did do regional theater for a few years, and I thought, oh, maybe one day I'll have, you know, maybe I'll have a part in a movie or something like that. But I wanted to be, you know, you don't really go to theater school in hopes of becoming a movie star or something like that. And I love to be on stage. It makes me the happiest. It can be draining. And when you have children, I feel like I have to choose very carefully because it can take a lot out of you doing a play. And I've been very lucky with the plays that I've gotten and the playwrights I've been able to work with. I've been so lucky. Mm. So lucky.
There's so many wonderful letters in this book, Dear Mr. You. There's one to Dear Grandpa. It's an ode to your grandfather, whom you never knew. You describe his work as a minor and his worries about having his only son, I guess, stationed in the Philippines, right, near the end of World War
II? Exactly. Yeah, and I did never get to meet him. But, I felt in a strange little way I got to – it sounds a little bit corny, but I felt like I got to spend a little bit of time with him when I was writing it and seeing my father through his eyes. And because that story of him sending moonshine to my dad in the middle of the war was – my dad loved to tell that story, and I loved being able to tell it from his point of view.
We follow you on your journey in the book as you fantasize about being saved by the Beatles. In one chapter, you talk in a voice that, quote, only ants can hear. I loved that one.
Yeah.
And then the Dear Firefighter letter, where you paint a picture of one of the 9/11 firefighters in New York covered in ash and the connection you feel with him. You rushed to embrace him, right?
That was a really incredible moment. Yes. And being in New York City right after 9/11 was that enormous gift that came on the heels of this unspeakable tragedy.
Yes.
Because people were so incredible to each other. People were so lovely to each other. They were so kind and so careful and so considerate. And I was buying some steel-toed boots in a store, and a woman came up to me and she said, "Are those for the workers?" And I said, "Yes." And she started pulling money out of her wallet and handing it to me. People were really, it was like entering a different world for those few weeks there.
That's right. Here's Gina in Slidell, Louisiana. Gina, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just wanted to ask Ms. Parker, like, how does she, like, I love you in red. That's my favorite. Red 1 and 2, awesome. But I also want to ask you, like, how do you juggle film and movies and stage and able to read and write and kids and how do you bring it all together?
It's a lot, Gina. Thank you. Mary Louise Parker.
Well, I don't do an awful lot of grown-up things, which I've made sort of a resolution to try to do more. To try to go out and go, you know, to events that grown-ups are at. And it is hard, but I've been so lucky that it does allow me big stretches of time with my kids. And it just means that there are projects that I have to turn down that if I were single, I would probably have leapt at. But it's so much more satisfying for me at night to be able to put my kids in bed and make sure that they're that moment after they're in bed and they're asleep and I know that they brushed their teeth and they did the neti pot and they're in the, everybody's warm and their humidifiers and it's just like their homework is done, their clothes are laid out, and I just thought, okay, oh, that's like, and then I can, you know, read a book for a little while. That's a really, really nice feeling, and I'm lucky enough to get to have it often. And I do end up giving up work and social experiences for that, but I do not feel like I'm losing in any way.
So, Gina, thank you so much for the call. We're down to our final seconds here. Mary Louise Parker, after this distinguished career, this new book, all these awards, Golden Globe, and on, what's next?
Christmas. I love Christmas. I love the holidays. I love the holidays.
1 month at a time. Well, thank you for this gift of this book, Dear Mr. You.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can find us on Twitter and on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.